Welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa, I'm your host, and in today's episode, I'm speaking with physician and longevity expert Dr. Bill Bruno. Bill and I spoke about simple habits to add years to your life, genetics versus lifestyle, and the three most preventable causes of death. If you like the show, please subscribe and give us a rating or share the episode with someone who might find it helpful. Thank you so much. And as always, if you want help with your nutrition and fitness goals, we are your go-to coaches. Just hit the contact link in the show notes. Now, onto my conversation with Bill. Dr. Bill Bruno, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Lisa. Happy to be here.
Yeah, it's my absolute pleasure. I'm really excited to talk about longevity and just all things health and health optimization in general. Before we get into the nitty-gritty, though, please tell us what you are excited for the listener to learn from this conversation today.
I'd like to leave the listener with, some actionable steps that they can take toward, not only looking better, feeling better, living longer, right? I think a lot of times you listen to these podcasts and it gives a lot of information, not really sure where to go or what to do next. And I'll sort of move through that hopefully during the show and give actionable tips, whether it's about nutrition, exercise, sleep, which diagnostic tests to get, et cetera. So hopefully they can get some good value out of this.
Amazing. Yeah, I'm all about practical takeaways. First, though, tell us a bit more about yourself, how you got to where you are today, because I know that it's also been a journey that was influenced by your own personal struggles. So please tell us a little bit about your journey.
Yeah, I'm a board certified plastic surgeon. I'm practicing in West Hollywood, Beverly Hills, California. I've been here for about 21 years now. But how I got into longevity was about maybe 8 or 9 years ago. I sort of on a routine blood test discovered I had high cholesterol, which led to some other tests, stress test, treadmill test, which was okay. And then I, just because I knew about this test being a physician, I asked for a calcium scan. Also known as a calcium, coronary calcium scan, calcium score, basically a CAT scan of the heart, and it showed it had a lot of calcifications, which led to some other tests, the CT angiogram, which basically led to me discovering I had, mild to moderate coronary artery disease, which I had no idea. And at the time I was 49, and it really led me down a pathway of trying to optimize health, nutrition. I became almost vegan or very heavily plant-based for a while there, and just had me look at my exercise and sleep and what I was doing because, as a typical doctor, I was sort of neglecting my health. But that's what really led me down the pathway of longevity. So I just sort of began to learn through, podcasts and books and webinars and conferences more about longevity and how I can use lifestyle and lifestyle medicine, which is actually a specialty in medicine, to improve my health and health span and lifespan. So that's sort of how I came at it. And I started sharing all this advice with my plastic surgery patients. Some of them were listening, some of them just wanted to have, a surgery or procedure look better. But I realized a lot of people, they do want to live longer. They don't always verbalize that, but it's they want to live better and live longer. So that's just a brief summary of how I got, to where I'm at now. And it led me to create like a digital course on wellness and longevity and a coaching program on body recomposition. So that's a summary.
Amazing. Yeah, I think it's so great that you're trying to put it out to the masses as well and not just the one-on-one clients that you're seeing face to face, especially when it comes to longevity, because I mean, lifespan doesn't really mean anything, in my opinion, if we don't also have health span. So really, we need to look at the quality of life also. And you mentioned lifestyle a few times there in terms of lifestyle methods that we can use. But I'm curious in regards to lifestyle versus genetics. We hear different things. What matters more? Can we really, influence our genetics? Some people go around like blaming their genetics for certain things. What's your take on the whole spiel?
I think most of the studies that we have, like twin studies and related studies like that, would suggest it's maybe like 20% genetics. Some people argue, maybe they would say it's 15 or 30, but I think Suffice it to say, the majority of your health span is influenced by your lifestyle. So let's say 80%, you can overcome maybe some poor genetics that you might have. Maybe you're predisposed to Alzheimer's, maybe you're predisposed to a certain cancer, but you can absolutely change that. And you know, the listener should know that, or the viewer should know that you have a lot of control over that. You're not just dealt these genetic cards and you're like, well, my father or grandfather or grandparents died of a certain disease. You are not destined to get those diseases. It's, you know, epigenetics is the whole field, right? Where how you live your life will determine how certain genes are expressed or not expressed. So yeah, I mean, absolutely, you have a lot of control over this. And whether you're starting it in your 20s, 30s, or 40s, 50s, or 60s, you can make changes in your daily life through the foods you eat, the movement that you do, the sleep that you get, to really impact your life. So yeah, absolutely. We all have control over this, and you're not just a, you know, victim to your genetics.
Yeah, I think they often say genetics load the gun, but if we pull the trigger or not is sort of like the lifestyle, you know, like how we might have a certain predisposition towards something or be more prone, more inclined to something depending on our genetics, but it really is being sort of exposed or yeah, triggered through the way that we live. I think that always paints a little bit of a nice picture. And you mentioned three things there. You mentioned movement, nutrition, and sleep. And I heard you speak about simple habits that are allowing us to add years to our life. Would those three be such habits, or are there more than those three?
You know, I think those are probably the, you made me say foundational, like people talk about pillars, right, of longevity. Yeah, I think nutrition, exercise, sleep, stress management, you know, some people would add that maybe as like a fourth pillar, but I think those are important because we can control those easily. And then I talk about in my course and coaching, like which tests to get. I think that's sort of later on. You know, you don't have to necessarily get all these fancy genetic tests or imaging studies done, because we as people can do these things each day. And I think that's where you're going to get the most impact. Like before you get to the red light therapy, before you get to the cold plunge or the hot sauna, I think most of your health span will be determined by the food, the movement, and the sleep. And then those other things are great to have. If you can get a you know, glutathione infusions or NAD infusions, all those other things. I think that's an add-on to it, but most of the big changes are going to be made by what you eat, how you move, and how well you sleep.
Awesome. Yeah, let's talk a little bit more in detail about each one of those, if you don't mind. So, in regards to sleep, what is your recommendation if someone listening to this is like, okay, I want those practical takeaways. I know I should improve my sleep, but what does that really mean?
Yeah, I would say first, I think sleep is probably the most underrated, right, of these pillars. A lot of people tend to ignore it. They don't think it's important. You know, oh, I'll sleep when I'm dead, sort of, you know, mentality or philosophy has been popular. But I think, yeah, I would say one of the most important habits is going to bed at the same time every night and waking up at the same time every day. Let's say that is a probably one of the most important habits, you know, surrounding sleep. And that includes the weekends. You know, don't try to catch up for poor sleep during the week by trying to sleep a lot on the weekends. It's not really going to work that well for you. But as far as tips, yeah, you know, creating this great sleep environment, you know, sleep hygiene as it's referred to, like the habits around sleep, not eating too close to bedtime, not, you know, exercising too close to bedtime, not using your tablets and screens and phones because the blue light is really going to destroy the melatonin production, you know, things like that. But, you know, again, to just back up, I'd say it starts in the day. Like when you wake up, what are you doing in the morning? Like, you know, getting that morning sunlight is really critical. And this has become popular, I think, over the last couple of years. You know, you see this on a lot of influencers and Andrew Huberman's and things, you know, people like that. That first, you know, maybe sunlight that you're getting or not getting is really important. So try to get outside, and this is sunlight not coming through a window. Try to step outside, get sunlight. That sun, you know, through your retina into your brain, it's going to change the hormones. It's going to trigger, you know, serotonin release. It's going to help create melatonin later that night. So I guess sleep begins in the morning, getting sunlight, getting some bright light for 10 to 20 minutes to help set the stage for all these hormonal changes that are going to happen at night. But back to sleep, creating that good environment, trying to, go to bed at a reasonable time. Most of the deep sleep happening right between 10 p.m. and 1 or 2 in the morning. And deep sleep is where muscle growth happens. Deep sleep is where fat loss happens. Deep sleep is where brain detoxification happens. So if you're going to bed at midnight or 1, you're kind of missing that opportunity. So if you could sleep, let's say, between 9 or 10 p.m. and maybe 6 or 7 in the morning, I think that's a good time to be asleep. And about the habits I was mentioning, no food, ideally 3 or 4 hours before bedtime, screens, maybe 1 or 2 hours. And if you do have to be on a screen or you're watching TV, I'd recommend using some sort of blue blocker glasses, whether that's a yellow tint or an orange tint or red tint, to really cut down that blue light exposure. Because I think the blue light and artificial indoor light is really destroying our sleep. And it's been doing it for probably decades, but we kind of ignore it. We don't really think about light and how it impacts our sleep. So that's something, I would urge the listener to sort of those habits that you do. It's not necessarily reaching for magnesium or melatonin. I think there are things that can help with sleep, but creating your habits and starting to wind down a few hours before bedtime and just, treating that sleep very seriously. Sleep in a cold room, a dark room, a quiet room. Maybe you're going to have a sleep mask on. Maybe you're going to have a cooling mattress that to help get your body temperature down, and that will help you drift off into it and get a better night's sleep. But those are just a few thoughts on sleep. I didn't want to go on too much there.
No, I love it. I love the anchoring of like fixed bedtime, fixed rising time, and the anchoring when it comes to the daylight exposure, or ideally sunlight exposure. I'm a huge fan of that, and I personally have felt or am feeling the benefits of that for sure. I think it's so funny how with kids, we kind of it makes sense to us that they need to have a bedtime routine. You bathe them and then you read them a book to kind of wind them down and like all these kind of things. And then we expect that when we're reaching adulthood or even in our teenage years, that just like from one drop of the head or from one second to the next, we'd be able to fall asleep. You're answering that email or text to someone quickly, and then I want to fall asleep into the best night's sleep ever. Like, that's not going to happen. You need to like actually set yourself, your brain, your body, your physiology in general up for a good night's sleep. So it takes some effort, really.
It does. It takes some work. And then I would also emphasize, do that on the weekends as well. I know the tendency is to stay up late, maybe have a few cocktails or what have you, and then try to sleep in late. That just sets up this what social jet lag. So then by Monday, you're devastated because now you have to get up early again. So yeah, those habits are important, as you mentioned, for a child as it is into adulthood.
Absolutely. Okay, so let's move on to the next pillar, perhaps movement. What would be some practical steps someone can take, whether they are already exercising or not exercising at all, when it comes to optimizing their movement for longevity?
Yeah, I would say to start, if someone isn't really doing much, start with walking. Walking is very underrated. Most people, they say, are averaging maybe 3,000 steps a day or 4,000 steps in the US, which is defined as sedentary. So if you are doing no exercise, I would say go for a 10-minute walk several times a day or go for a 30-minute walk. You'll start to, gradually get your step count up there. I think that walking after a meal, if you're going to pick a time to do it, walk after a meal to try to control blood sugars and your insulin response. So 10 or 15-minute walk after your largest meal of the day. I think that's a great practical thing that all of us should do and certainly could do. But as far as the step count, people talk about 10,000 steps. I mean, I don't know if that's necessary. I think there's a recent study saying 7,000, maybe it's 8,500, but see where you're at now and begin to track it. Maybe you're not even looking. You're most of the iPhones and there's lots of wearables out there to track these things. But the more you track something, you'll be more intentional about it, and you'll think like, I didn't even look at my step count till a few years ago, and I was like less than 3,000 because I'm either in an office or I'm standing in an operating room. Now I have a walking pad in my office, and now I'm up to like 6,000, 6,500. That's not great, but it's better than 2,000. So wherever you're at, try to make that a habit and try to walk a little bit more each day. beyond walking, intensity does matter to some degree. So they talk about zone two, which is this rate of, exertion that's a little bit more than just a casual pace of walking, walking at a pace that you can, still talk to someone, but it's a little bit, labored. But that recommendation would be, maybe 150 minutes a week, right, of this zone two. That could look like, a couple hours a week where you're on a treadmill doing that, or you're walking outside. That's foundational. I think that helps set the stage for your overall cardiorespiratory fitness. Now, you want to add to that, I think most people should, most people don't, is weight training, right? Resistance training. The more muscle you have on your body, the longer that you'll live. And it doesn't matter if you're starting this in your 50s, 60s, or 70s. And there are studies to show people can gain significant muscle mass, improve their body composition, starting weight training later in life. So, at least twice a week, I think preferably 3 times a week. Maybe you're doing a total body workout where you're working each body part multiple times throughout, the week. So I'd say foundationally looking at movement, starting with walking, try to get your maybe 6, 7, 8,000 steps a day. Try to do a little bit more intense version of that. And then some people would even try to do some sprint training once a week, talking about VO2 max, that's how well does your body consume oxygen, use oxygen, to create energy. It's almost looking at your mitochondrial efficiency. You say, well, how good is your VO2 max? And for the listener, VO2 max is just something you can get that measured in a lab where they put like a mask on your face and they run you on a treadmill or a bike. But that is the number one predictor of longevity, is this VO2 max test. Now, it costs a few hundred dollars to get it, or a cheap way to do this is run or walk as fast as you can, as long as you can, for 12 minutes. It's called the Cooper test. And then there's a calculator online, and take that distance, say it's a mile and a half. You put in this calculator and it'll tell you based on your age where you are, and where it'll give you a really close calculation of what your VO2 max is. Because VO2 max isn't something your doctor's going to necessarily check on you. You sort of have to go to like a fitness center, maybe a physical therapy center, a place like that. So again, just to summarize, that I'd say walking, daily step count, aerobic activity, weight training, and then maybe you'll do several minutes a week of just that sprint training if you really want to try to boost your VO2 max.
I'm a huge fan of walking for so many reasons. Like, I really think it is very underrated, as you mentioned as well. I think also for mental benefits, it gives us, for me, it's almost a form of meditation, just kind of like letting my mind wander. Or, of course, if you're like, oh, claiming very, I'm very busy, blah, 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 you can still listen to a podcast during that time, call somebody if you really want to. It's better than sitting at a desk or on the couch doing that. So, yeah, I'm a huge fan of that. And when it comes to the strength training, I think we're beginning to see more and more that really muscle mass. I've even heard it called being called the longevity organ, where it's like, because of course it is also influencing so many other things. It's influencing our blood sugar control, our mitochondria in general, the cell quality that we have. It's not just about a certain way that we look or even posture or anything like that, but also, of course, how autonomous we can live into old age and how dependent we are on other people. So I think that's such an important point. And I like how you're kind of giving us the hierarchy of like depending on what time you have available, because if we start by just sprint training but we're neglecting everything else, I think that is a little bit dangerous almost, if you don't have the foundational strength or reflexive, like the muscle mass for that to hold your body essentially. So that automatically, of course, leads us to the third pillar, which you mentioned earlier, nutrition. And you for yourself said that for a while you were plant-based. I'm assuming you no longer are following a plant-based diet. Or yeah, maybe you can share your recommendation for the general public, but also, of course, what you're doing at the moment.
Yeah, I think what I did personally, I was so scared of, having heart disease, and I was like, well, I'm just not going to eat meat, or and not just red meat, like everything. But more recently, I introduced, pasture-raised eggs. I feel that's fine for most people. It's fine for me. I think, grass-fed beef, grass-fed meat. I think that's fine. Everyone has to sort of decide what's good for them, and maybe they're checking their blood. Like, I get my blood checked every 3 months, so I'm looking at these things closely. But I think for the viewer, I would say eating mostly whole foods and avoiding the ultra-processed foods, that's the best diet. And I think we can all agree on that. You know, we don't want to necessarily, I know everyone tries to label these things, or is paleo better than keto or carnivore? And, you know, certain of those diets might be right for each individual, but, you know, it's hard to give universal advice on something that's so unique like this. But I would say, I think everyone would agree, and all experts in this field would say, eating mostly whole foods, avoiding the ultra processed foods, avoiding, you know, if you eat out often, you know, you're going to get seed oils, you're going to get these other vegetable oils cooked in your food. So you have to almost accept that, or try to minimize your takeout foods, minimize eating out. I think that's probably one of the more foundational things I would say, is try to eat more whole foods. You know, related to that, you mentioned muscle mass is the protein. I think people are starting to get the message to try to optimize and eat more protein so they can retain more muscle mass. You know, what is that? I think, you know, a lot of people will say close to about 1 gram per pound of body weight, or maybe 0.8 grams per pound of body weight. So if you weigh 150 pounds and you want to be 130, try to eat 130 grams of protein a day. You know, that goes for men, women, young, old. It especially goes for older people because they have this anabolic resistance where it becomes harder to sort of keep their muscle mass, let's say after the age of 60, roughly. But I would emphasize protein, 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight, eat whole foods, and let's not forget fiber. No one really talks about this. I think try to get 30, 35 grams of fiber a day. That's like the minimum. And very few Americans are even hitting that. I think it's like, you know, it's like 2 or 3% are getting there. So, you know, eat a multiple diversity of plants per week. Try to eat 30 or 35, 40 different plants. That goes for nuts, beans, seeds, you know, everything, spices per week. This is great for the microbiome, right? We're sort of learning so much about the microbiome, which are all the bacteria in our intestines, specifically more so, I guess, in the colon. And that microbiome controls almost everything. It controls your mood. It controls your brain health. It controls, you know, our immune system, right? So I think to summarize that without going too far into the nutrition, and I get, notice I didn't mention calories. I don't think that's as important. Get your protein, get your fiber, because those are almost natural GLP-1 agonists. It's almost like a natural way to control your weight. You know, people are paying thousands of dollars for Ozempic. But if you eat more protein and fiber, you'll feel more full. And if you eat the fiber, that's what the bacteria in your colon need to optimize your health. And oh, by the way, you'll probably lose weight. You'll probably look better. You'll have more energy, et cetera. So that's what I would say, is eat mostly whole foods. Think about protein, optimize it 1 gram per pound of body weight, and try to get at least 30 or maybe 40 grams of fiber a day.
I love how you are really focusing on getting people to think about what to have more of. Exactly to your point, quite often we are focused so much on, oh, I should have less of this. I need to cut this out. I'm not allowed to have that. And I think that all puts just such a negative connotation on the whole nutrition aspect, as opposed to thinking, okay, if I have more protein and fiber, I'm automatically going to eat less of the processed stuff. So, but I'm thinking about it in a much more positive, creative kind of way. So I really, really like that. And I couldn't agree more on the aspect of the importance of protein, of course, fiber as well. And I also agree that not enough people talk about fiber, especially when it comes to its connections, according to the research, to longevity and, you know, preventing heart disease and all these things, as you would know much better than I do. But the only thing I would say when it comes to the calories, or when I think it is worth, you know, focusing on the calories, if someone is already eating quite, quote unquote, clean, and they still have excess body fat levels, we do want to make sure that we are getting those down into the normal range, because I believe just simply being obese or even overweight, in and of itself, is a huge risk factor, where we have that energy toxicity, so to speak, even if we're eating really, really high quality foods. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, most people, at least most Americans, are eating way too much of the ultra processed foods, and they're carrying around way too much body weight, whether, you know, the statistic is like 2/3 of people are obese or overweight. So it's almost unusual to be fit. It's almost unusual to be like quote unquote normal weight. But I absolutely agree with you.
And you, well, I mean, talking about risk factors for death, what are the, let's say, three most common causes of death?
Yeah, number one in the world in the United States, men and women, it's heart disease. Cardiovascular disease, which if you count stroke in there, we're talking about atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. This accounts for, 19 million or so, 20 million deaths globally a year. And in the United States, if you count heart disease and stroke, that's about 36% of all deaths. So, how do we manage that? How do we, avoid that? And I think, again, as we were talking about so far the whole time, is lifestyle, right? The sleep, the movement, and the nutrition. But for me, getting those tests and thinking about these tests, the first one I mentioned, the coronary artery and calcium score, I think anybody over 40 should really give some thought into that, regardless of family history. Go to your primary care doctor and say, can I get a coronary artery calcium scan? It's a CAT scan of the heart. There's no contrast injected. It's relatively, cost effective. I think it's about $200. It might not be covered by insurance, but it's worth getting. And it'll tell you if you have any calcifications in your heart. And if you do, then there's another test. It's a CT angiogram where they inject dye into your heart, and they can actually tell you the degree of blockage in certain vessels because now they use AI. It's a test that's called a Cleerly scan. Now, that one you might have to pay $2,000 for, but these tests, I think if you're in your 40s, 50s, 60s, these are worth doing because unlike a cholesterol test, which might show that you might be at higher risk, these imaging tests actually tell you if you have disease or not, like the presence of disease or the absence of it. And I mean, I would stress those. And there's also another test you can get of your neck. It's a carotid intima media thickness test, where it's a specialized ultrasound of the neck to see if you have plaque buildup here. Because if you have it in your neck, you most likely have it in your heart. So, unfortunately, in the United States, these tests aren't covered typically, and they're not really being used as screening tools. If anything, someone might refer you to a stress test like I had. But that's not indicative of you have disease, and that's not really a good predictor of if you're going to have a heart attack or a major cardiac event. So I mean, I'd say men and women, especially women after menopause, they lose some of this protective effects of estrogen, so they may not see the cardiac deaths in their, say, mid-50s as men do. They might see that more pushed back a decade, maybe into their middle to late 60s. But I think everyone should be thinking about these tests because part of longevity is living longer. So let's not die of something that's avoidable, like heart disease, right? And if it's going to kill like one out of every three people potentially, that's something that needs to be taken seriously. And if you need to take, pharmacologic means to get your cholesterol lower, to lower your risk, then do so. A lot of people seem to be really against statins these days, but if you're taking the right dose and if you need it, if you have a history, it's really important to take that or maybe consider a baby aspirin. These are questions to have with your primary care doctor. And if you're not getting those answered, maybe seek out a functional medicine doctor. Maybe seek out an integrative medicine or a lifestyle medicine doctor, someone who can maybe give you better answers. But that's the number one. I know you asked me for the top three, but that's the number one. And behind that, not too far behind, is cancer. Cancer is the number two cause of death, men and women, in the United States. Unfortunately, that's a lot harder to reduce. Like heart disease can almost be eliminated with lifestyle and pharmacology. Cancer, however, it is harder, but all the things we've been talking about, all these lifestyle improvements, will also reduce your risk of cancer. Are there good tests? Sure, there are different tests out there. There's mammograms and there's all the screening tests everyone should get. But lately people are doing these full body MRIs. You can detect a cancer or a tumor at a very early stage, and it's much more treatable. There are blood tests out there that you can test for 50 or 60 different cancers. One's called Galleri. It's a blood test that they call it a liquid biopsy, is sort of a slang term, but it will screen for cancers that we're not screening for with mammograms and Pap smears and other tests like that, like colonoscopies. You need to do all those things, but if you're over the age of 50, that's a risk factor for cancer. So if you're over 50, maybe you would think about getting a blood test specifically looking at cancers. Now, that's not covered by insurance. It might cost $800 or $900, but it might be something to look at along with the full body MRI. I think with time, some of these things will be covered, but heart disease and cancer, those are one and two, and that's probably those two alone probably account for like 60 or 70% of all the deaths. Third behind that, depending on what year you're looking at, we're not going to talk about it, but it's like accidental deaths, trauma, injury, like that's different. But as far as things you can control, metabolic disease like type 2 diabetes, that's certainly up there. It's probably in the top five or six, and you can count Alzheimer's in there, dementia. Type 2 diabetes is totally a lifestyle disease and controllable with everything we've mentioned up to this point. Alzheimer's, you can maybe delay the onset. And you talked about walking before. Yeah, walking is a very simple thing to help stave off potentially a diagnosis of Alzheimer's till later in life. Getting good sleep, believe it or not, that's going to detoxify your brain, and you're less likely of having neurodegenerative diseases later in life. But I'd say those are probably the top two. Again, back, heart disease, cancer, and then if you want to say type 2 diabetes and Alzheimer's, they're probably in the top like five or six.
Okay, I'm sorry, I missed the second test. I think the first one was the calcium, the other one that I caught was the neck scan, and what was the third one that you mentioned?
For the heart?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that's called a CT angiogram. Also, one's called a Cleerly scan. This is where they inject dye into your blood vessels and they do the same CAT scan of your heart. So it is dye. There's a little bit more radiation, but it gives you a very clear picture. I had this done twice, actually, most recently 2 years ago. And what's important about that test, it tells you if you have soft plaques, which are unstable plaques in the lining of the blood vessels, versus hard plaques, which are stable. A calcium scan will just tell you the stable ones, which is nice to know, but a CT angiogram gives you the best image. And I think, if you're especially like, say you're a man over the age of 50, I think that's a really, really compelling test to think about or at least discuss with your physician.
Okay, amazing. Yeah, thank you. I think you painted a very conclusive a picture of the most or the highest risk causes of death. And so let's say somebody is covering all these bases that we just talked about when it comes to nutrition, movement, and sleep as well. What would you say are some nice to haves from here? You touched on magnesium, you also touched on like cold plunge and sauna and whatever. If you truly feel like someone is ready for a bit more, or even maybe you yourself, if you have certain practices that go beyond that, what would you recommend?
I would say maybe mention a couple of foundational supplements. Supplements is a really popular sort of a hot topic. I think they're just that. It's supplemental to all these lifestyle things, hopefully, that you can start doing or that you are doing. But maybe a few foundational ones, like taking a good omega-3 supplement. Most people aren't eating enough fatty fish, and most people have a low omega-3 index. This is a score you can get. It's an at-home kit. It's a finger stick test. See where your omega-3 levels are at. And finding a good source for that. I take a liquid one by Nordic Naturals. I think it's a reputable brand. I think creatine, taking 5 grams a day. Like I think most people would agree that beyond just muscle health, there's now discovering their cognitive benefits, maybe even higher doses, like 10 grams a day. So I'd recommend creatine to everyone, men, women, young, old, 5 grams a day, not just for bodybuilders. I think people think it's just for athletes. In addition to those two, I would think about vitamin D. Most people are deficient in that. That's a simple blood test that you can check to see if you're deficient. Magnesium, most people are deficient in that. You can start taking that and get those levels checked. Maybe sort of a green powder like an AG1. I think there's some value in taking something like that. But I think beyond that, there's far too many supplements to talk about. And but if you get a few foundational ones like that, I think it's a good, it may be a multivitamin. It's a good area, a good way to fill in the gaps because most people don't have optimal nutrition. So they might need these things. But I guess the omega-3s and the creatine and maybe a collagen powder. I mean, those are a couple, maybe the top four or five that I think about and that are very well researched that I think your listener or, viewers might consider. Beyond that, as far as sort of the interesting fun things, the devices, like I've been using a red light machine at home. It's like a panel. I sit in front of it for 15 minutes a day. Lots of data behind this for mitochondrial health, which is good cellular health, gives you a lot of energy, decreases inflammation. Beyond a red light, hot sauna, huge amounts of data supporting this for not only reducing cardiovascular events, helping with Alzheimer's and cognitive health, and all these studies coming out of Finland where the number of times you sauna per week matters. So if you can get up to a point where you're doing four or five, six times a week, these are maybe 15 or 20 minute sessions at a certain temperature. I believe it's like 180 degrees Fahrenheit, has a lot of value. It almost simulates exercise. So you can have even older people go into saunas and the sweating is good, releasing toxins, but it has tremendous cardiovascular benefit. So if I were to think about something like that, a cold plunge, I mean, there's some value, but there is not nearly as much data as there is with hot saunas. If you like cold plunging, I think it's something maybe to do in the morning. I wouldn't do it after a weight training session, right? It can blunt your gains. But, so I think if the listener wants to try something, I think hot saunas, and red light therapy. And, there are places now where you can go do this. You don't have to buy one in the home. Like you got to have a monthly membership, right? And maybe test them out. Beyond that, I mean, there's hyperbaric oxygen, there are other things, but I think, again, you can go really crazy with that. And is it maybe gonna, move the needle 2 or 3% in your life? I don't know. I mean, again, starting with the foundation, like in my course, I created this longevity pyramid where the base is what we've been talking about, the exercise, the nutrition, the sleep, and then building upon that, which tests should you be getting? The tests we mentioned before. And then above that, let's say having a purpose in life, right? Having, having a good mindset, the proper mindset. Like, I want to live longer. Why do you want to live longer? You want to do it for your kids or your grandkids or, whatever your reasons are, philanthropy, whatever that is. And then, the importance of social connections. I don't want to leave that out. That's really important. We learned this from all the people in the blue zones, right? People are living to be 100. They're not doing it alone. And they're doing it with, natural movement. They're doing it with having a sense of community, having a positive mindset and a positive attitude in life. Those people live on average like 15% longer than people who don't have a, positive mindset. So, to answer your questions, I guess those are the add-ons. I'm sort of moving up this pyramid, but yeah, I'll stop there for now. I hope I didn't ramble on.
No, I think that's absolutely wonderful. I love your holistic approach, really, that is all inclusive also of the mental state and our connection, social connections. And as you mentioned, the blue zones, I think that has been, well, I believe there was even like something out there on Netflix about the blue zones. But of course, before that, also, we saw the data on just what they have in common. And as you pointed out, like having a strong why. Why are you doing this? Why do you want to keep on living? And so on. Very, very, very important factor that often doesn't get spoken about. So, yeah, thank you so much for painting such a wonderful picture here for us. And I really recommend everybody go and check out your course that will obviously link everything in the show notes. And I also like the image of the pyramid because, as we know, if we want to change habits or if we want to implement changes, it's best to do it in small steps, one thing at a time, and not, change your life entirely. Sometimes that is warranted, but for the majority of people, I think it's gonna stick the best if we were doing small things, starting with the walking, including a little bit more protein, maybe swapping out some of these processed things. So yeah, bit by bit, creating this whole new lifestyle. I really, really like it. So thank you so much for your time today, Bill. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Yes, thank you for having me. And I would just leave your listeners with this. Just take action. We covered so many different topics. Just pick one or two things. Maybe it's the steps, maybe it's the protein, maybe it's something surrounding sleep, and take action and try to track something, and you will have a better life and you will live longer and hopefully feel better.
Amazing. Thank you. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Bill. Thank you so much for tuning in. Go and give us both a follow. And remember, if you want help with your nutrition and fitness goals, we'd love to guide you. One more thing before you go. If you are looking for premium supplements, our partner, Fat Muscle Project, has got you covered. Head to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more. And feel free to use our code NCL for your chance to win a $250 gift card every month.